Our meeting. We have two agenda items. The one was to be formally introduced to the NCCS and to just very briefly compare notes in terms of the roles and responsibilities of the NCCS as they see it and as members see it. There are some new members that are here for the first time, so that was just going to really be an introductory meeting. We didn't expect the NCCS to prepare anything particularly, just us to meet them. The second part of the meeting was to have discussions on matters that we had referred to the department, specifically around parole issues that we picked up either through our oversight or through correspondence. And we thought that the NCCS could be here to get a sense of the kinds of matters that we pick up, because we do know that the parole review is constituted from your members, just so that you can get a sense of what is happening there. Those were really the two agenda items that we had for today. We have scheduled the meeting from 9 o'clock until 1 o'clock. Doesn't necessarily have to be from 9 until 1 o'clock. We don't expect the first part to be very long anyway, and the second part, from the 2nd of March to the 10th of, 2nd of February to about the 10th of April, we had about 27 items that we had either referred to the department for consideration and so that we could conclude the matter, and we will then discuss that. And our last meeting with the department was on the 13th. So thank you, Minister and Deputy Minister, for being here. Maybe we'll allow you to introduce the new board and first have a discussion around there, and then we'll move to the parole matters afterwards. So if we deal with the first agenda item. From our side, we have apologies from Mam Nyanda. She's been sick for a while, and she's not here. And then Baba Ndlovu from the IFP is busy with the Committee on South African Police Services, so he's not here. And other members, I'm sure, will join us as we go along. But the formal apologies are from Nyanda and from Mr. Ndlovu, who's occupied in another portfolio committee. Can we hand over then to you, Minister?
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, Honourable Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee. Justify the Chair of the National Council of Correctional Services, your deputies, Judge Lidwaba, Judge Lecoq in absentia, your colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. I'm grateful for the opportunity to address the Portfolio Committee on the occasion of introducing the members of the NCCS to you. Chairperson, I'm sure I'm not expected to just introduce and give names to you, but I'm sure you would want me to also give a context of the appointment of the National Council of Correctional Services, particularly because at 10:30, I'll be attending the Joint Committee of Cabinet. Thank you. Although these members were effectively recommended for appointment by you, we do, however, feel that their appearance before you has been long overdue, and I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to share with you the work of the council as well. The Correctional Services Act, in sections 83 and 84, makes provision for the establishment of the NCCS. In fact, this body has been in existence in one form or another since 1982. The main purpose of the body is to fulfill an advisory role to the Minister of Correctional Services. Section 84 of the Correctional Services Act defines the function of the NCCS as follows. Primary function being to advise at the request of the Minister or on its own accord in developing policy in regards to the correctional system and the sentencing process. The Minister, number two, must refer draft legislation and major proposed policy developments regarding the correctional system to the National Council on Correctional Services for its comment and advice. Three, the National Commissioner must provide the necessary information and resources to enable the National Council to perform its primary function. The National Council may examine any aspect of the correctional system and refer any appropriate matter to the inspecting judge. And lastly, the National Council must fulfill any other function ascribed to it in this Act. In terms of Section 83(1) of the Act, it is the Minister who must appoint a National Council. It was in terms of this provision that after the necessary consultations, including with Parliament, I appointed this council, consisting of 18 members, for a 5-year term which comes to an end on the 28th of February 2015. In making this appointment, I have made sure that the appointment will cover the three categories provided for in terms of Section 83(2) of the Act. These categories of appointments are, one, members appointed by the Minister after consultation with relevant stakeholders stipulated in the Act. Two, members appointed by the Minister without consultation with any other body, that is two persons with special knowledge of the correctional system. Three, members appointed in consultation with the relevant parliamentary committees. The committee will recall that it fulfilled this role in 2010 in the appointment of the current members of the NCCS. The NCCS is chaired by a judge who is assisted by two court chairpersons who are also judges. In my term, I've initially appointed Honorable Judge Nzita from the Western Cape High Court, Cape High Court then, as chairperson, but she has since tendered her resignation due to other commitments. I have, from the 1st of February 2012, appointed Judge Desai as chairperson of the NCCS. Judge Desai has chaired the NCCS for a period of 10 years, and we are therefore grateful that once again he has accepted our invitation to join the Correctional Services family. He is assisted by Judges Lidwaba and Judge Likoko, who are both vice chairpersons. I felt it necessary, Chair, that instead of just introducing the members of the Council to you, I should give the committee a brief historical overview of the roles and functions fulfilled by the NCCS under each of these headings above. On the first legislative imperative, advise at the request of the Minister or on its own accord in developing policy in regard to the correctional system and sentencing processes. Since the establishment of this NCCS, there are a range of issues of a policy nature or that impact on the ability of DCS to implement policy that the NCCS has deliberated on and provided advice to the Minister and the Department. It has also, in the past, played an important role in public education and the changing of perceptions on parole and the social reintegration of offenders by engaging in public debate. Recently, the NCCS has also, in recent months, participated in a training of parole board members. And through this exercise, the NCCS is able to share the weaknesses and best practices that it had picked up by considering LIFR profile directly with parole board in an effort to strengthen the parole system in South Africa. On the second legislative imperative, Minister must refer draft legislation and major proposed policy development regarding the correctional system to the NCCS. In the past, the following key DCS policies have been referred to the NCCS for its comments and advice. the green paper on corrections, the white paper on corrections, and its concept in the implementation plan, the policy on the establishment of standards of excellence, and the policy on the establishment of parole boards in the current format. The current NCCS was, of course, instrumental in the development of a new policy framework for the consideration of medical parole and in the provision of feedback on the then draft Correctional Matters Amendment Bill. On the third legislative imperative, the National Council may examine any aspect of the correctional system and refer any appropriate matter to the inspecting judge. In the recent past, there has not been a formal referral of issues to the inspecting judge, but the judge always had a standing invite to the NCCS to attend its meeting and was given a slot on the agenda to provide an overview of his work and observations. The inspecting judge cannot, however, be involved in any of the functions performed by the NCCS, such as the consideration of LIFAs, but there has been a high degree of synergy between the two bodies over the years with regard to their approach to the correctional system. The fourth legislative imperative, the National Council must fulfill any other function ascribed to it in this Act. In terms of Section 76 of the Correctional Services Act, the Correctional Supervision and Parole Review Board consists of certain specified members of the NCCS. The decisions of the review board are well-reasoned and precedent-setting and should form an important resource to any parole board in deciding on similar matters. A further function ascribed to the NCCS by the Act is that of the consideration of LIFAs for recommendation to the minister. As we are all aware, the Van Vieren judgment suspended, unfortunately, the role of the NCCS to be fulfilled in the consideration of LIFAs sentence before the 1st of March 1994. The NCCS would, in terms of that ruling, only in 2015, have a role to play in this regard. But this position has since changed, since the handing down of the North Gauteng High Court judgment on the 25th of April 2011 in the matter of Van Wyk versus the Minister of Correctional Services. The NCCS is currently involved in a process of deciding how to approach the implementation of this government, of this judgment. I will, in due course, make an announcement in this regard once the NCCS has finalized its own processes and advised us appropriately. I'm aware that the NCCS has faced a number of challenges relating to the administration to support in the beginning of their term. I'm glad that we have now managed to establish a fully fledged office for the NCCS in Pretoria with dedicated support staff. We have, on several occasions, also held discussions with the National Treasury regarding the rate of remuneration on those members who qualify. Although the policy guidelines in this regard are somewhat rigid and not completely under our control, I've informed the NCCS to the extent where it is possible, the department will continue to impress upon National Treasury the need to recognize their special contribution to our work and remunerate them accordingly. I hope that, Chairperson, this will be a meaningful and mutually beneficial engagement. I now introduce Judge Desai to you. And seated next to the Judge Desai is Professor Nochulwana. And next to Ms. Professor Nochulwana is Madam Lusanda Radiamane. And next to her is Advocate Mzinyati. And then Dr. Randera. And right next to Judge Desai, to his right, is Judge Lidwaba. That is the team that has honored the invitation to appear before the Portfolio Committee this morning. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Minister, and I think on behalf of the committee, a warm welcome to the NCCS, and appreciation also for the work that you have done to date. Certainly some of us can attest to that. Others might be new. I have one question that I want to raise, and we had done that formally have not received a response from yourselves. Maybe it's coming today. But maybe I will afford members, if there are any comments that you'd want to make, contributions, questions, I'm sure Minister and the NCCS will respond. We haven't expected them to respond to any specifics, so I'd only entertain general questions around their roles and responsibilities. Specifics we can leave for some other time, please, if you don't mind. Mr. Self? Yes, sir.
Yes, well, thank you, Minister, and thank you to the members of the NCCS. I really have two general questions. And the one is that the legislative mandate of the NCCS is very clear, and it really relates in a silo-like manner to correctional services only. But there are a lot of things that affect other departments, and particularly sentencing is an issue which is dealt with by a completely different department, the Department of Justice. But it has a profound effect on the way that the Department of Correctional Services operates. Things like minimum sentencing. I just wondered to what extent does the National Council have the capacity or in practice does interact with colleagues in the Department of Justice really to share with them the implications of legislation that is the responsibility of that particular department. And the other question that I'd just like to raise, because there is an embarrassing riches of judges on the NCCS, is to understand clearly whether they've grappled at all with the concept of release date contained in the Act, because particularly in terms of the Waterkloof 2 judgment, there seems to be a great deal of judicial confusion about what exactly constitutes release date as defined in the Act, and I'm aware of several conflicting court judgments on that topic, and I think it would be desirable in the interests of justice for that confusion to be cleared up, because otherwise we're going to find ourselves in a situation where in this particular case two people were released and two people were not released, having been convicted at the same time for the same crime. So I was wondering whether the council or the minister for that matter could shed some light on that matter. Thank you.
Anybody else want to ask? Not? Can I just pose my one, and it's it was going to be specific to the department, but we had written to Justice Lidwaba on the 10th of April, so just for your learned opinion on this matter. We had asked the department, and the department has responded. And as I indicated, we had not received yours, and maybe we can just have a discussion. We wanted to understand the weight carried in terms of granting of parole, the weight carried by the restorative justice aspect of it. We have a situation, Minister, in Leoko, where somebody appeared before the parole board, recommended for parole, given a date, on the eve of his release on the 2nd of February or March. The department reversed that. And the rationale was that the victim's family, I think it was for murder, the victim's family on the eve of it opposed it. The victim's family is in KZN, this is in Leoko. And it was referred to the parole review board. The victim's family is never going to grant favorably, never going to, and that is known to everybody. But in that same facility, we were there last year sometime. A similar type of case with an inmate who was also convicted for murder, went before the parole board, was granted parole, and today is out. He's consulting. In both instances, these individuals have satisfied everything else. Everything else in terms of what is required and which we support. The only difference was, in this case, they denied parole, or not denied parole, but they said he must wait for another 6 months because of this incident, and they must try and reconcile. And we've had deputations of saying these people are not ever going to reconcile. The family in KZ are not. These people are based in Gauteng. We have a incident also in Leeuwpoort, where somebody again was supposed to appear before parole shortly. He was sent to Amtata because he must go and reconcile with the family in Amtata. Now, we were just wondering, how much weight does this, whilst we support it, how much weight does it carry? Because if somebody has done everything else, is this a showstopper? So that's just broadly over and above the issue that Mr. Sal has raised. If we can just have a broad discussion, because the specifics, we're certainly going to ask Mr. Modise to explain to us, but these are the type of things. In fact, this one went to you as a parole review board. So we're wondering how you guys view those things, plus the issues that were raised by Mr. Sal, which namely were the impact of other departments' minimum sentencing and the release date. Thank you. Minister, or...
I think before I allow the judge, Honorable Chairperson, it is always better for us when we are presented with the names of the people concerned, because it is easier to go to the record and give you the exact reason why the person was not released. But I found that most often than not, that officers at the correctional center never give the people concerned the real information and reasons why they have been denied parole. You may have been told that it is because of the restorative process that had taken place and that the family of the victim may have refused. But in my understanding, of course, the judges will speak for themselves and the NCCS in the life of that I have processed. That's why I won the name, so that I can then go back to the files and study the files and come back and give you a report, so that we don't speak in parables and talk about a case that we may not be familiar with. That is very important, that we cite the exact name of the person and even the two cases. Because in instances where I've had to make determine whether the person should be granted parole or not, the restorative process has not been the determining factor. But what is important is that all lifers who are being considered should at least engage in a process, so that in the event you take a decision to grant parole, at least the family or the families of the victims are ready and psychologically to receive the person in their midst. But I'm aware of cases where a profile will be given to me and discover that in fact there's never been an attempt to trace the family of the victim. And in that case, we've had to send it back, particularly where very aggressive and gruesome crimes have been committed. And we've had to send it back to say, trace the family, bring the profile in 6 months. And a number of the profiles that we've had to deal with are profiles of people that we had sent back to the centers in 2010. Some of them we sent back in April 2011, and we attended to them in November, December. But I think that it is proper that Judge Lidwaba and Judge Desai should provide you with a response to all the other issues that you've raised. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Minister. Maybe it was an oversight on our part. The two cases that we are talking about are not licensed, Minister. These are just ordinary. These are not licensed.
Okay.
The one is the Isop Khan. We did write to... You are aware of it. We did write to both the Minister and the Deputy Minister on that one, and we have been having interaction with Mr. Modise. The other one that I'm talking about in Amtata is a Sianda Mapasa, also from Leeuwpoort. You wouldn't have received that one, because that one is a new one. It's just the Isop Khan one that we use as a case study. But Sianda Mapasa, Minister, was the other one, and those names have been given to the to the to the department. So just to clarify that these were not lifers, these were just, I think one was 25 years and one was something else, so they were not lifers. But it was more the principle that we were interested in, so that it at least applies uniformly across the board, outside of lifers. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Let's deal with the first issue raised by the staff. It's correct that we should interact with the Justice Department in particular. We have done so in the past, but in previous incarnations of the NCCS, we have not done so in this instance. But I agree absolutely that the issue of minimum sentences is an issue which warrants interaction with the Department of Justice, simply because the increasing amount of people who are now serving minimum sentences. The minimum sentence regime is now been in operation for over 10 years, and we're seeing the impact of the massive sentences which were imposed since the introduction of that sentencing regime. When it was first introduced, it was meant for 2 years and was extended from time to time, and now it's become institutionalized. But I agree, personally speaking, and perhaps members of the council were aware of the clogging that it occasions in the justice system, in the correctional service system, that it should be at some stage or the other a reappraisal of the minimum sentence regime. That's an important factor in the number of lifers which are currently in correctional centres in the country today. The numbers far exceed what was the pattern in earlier years. It also has enormous consequences for the correctional system as a whole, because there are many people staying there serving sentences of 20, 25 years, and they have little hope of being released in the immediate future. It's true that there should be interaction, and we will take that up further with the Justice Department when time permits. But I've been back as chair since February, and we've had many other matters which have taken up our time, which have been occasioned largely as a result of the various judgments that have come, both from the Constitutional Court and judges and the courts in Gauteng. The second question that you asked relates to the Watercliffe 2. I don't think we had liberty to discuss specific cases. I think it would be inappropriate to discuss specific cases in this forum, because it's a public forum. But you've read the judgments. You should have read that one that I wrote last year, and I was no longer involved in correctional services. It sets out, I think, the position clearly. It's Godwin versus the Correctional Services, Department of Correctional Services. The problem with when the release date is, arises from a judgment which emanates from the Supreme Court of Appeals. We dealt with the chap called Mr. Price. And in that court, the court held that to determine your 1/6 of your sentence, you take into account your first release date, and they said the release date was the first time you considered for parole. Now, if you get sentenced to 10 years imprisonment, the first time you considered for parole, the current regime would be 10 years. So we deduct 1/6 of 10 years, it would be 2.5 years, or whatever the percentages are. That was probably a correct, I accept this correct interpretation of the law as it stood then. But immediately subsequent to that, at the instance of the National Council, the law was amended, and that section of it says that the release date is calculated from the date on which you first considered for release, has been deleted. So there is an element of misunderstanding with regard to that. But the correctional services has taken steps to address the uncertainty in clear and unequivocal terms. There has been a review launched of the Watercliffe judgment, which deals precisely with that point. And if we are wrong, we are wrong. We accept the outcome which the courts decide, which other courts will decide upon. And that matter is pending. And hopefully that matter will bring finality to that debate with regard to when the release date should be. If the interpretation is, as it was put in the prominent cases that we've heard, then people serve very short, if you're sentenced to 12 years, you serve a very small amount of your sentence before you're considered for parole. If that is correct, if that interpretation is correct, then it has unintended consequences and may have social consequences. You can't have people sentenced for moderate terms of imprisonment and then being released because they served a fraction of that sentence. Not only justice in this country, but the correctional service itself must retain its credibility in social, in the society in which we operate. But the correctional service, I can assure you that I've dealt with this matter, I've dealt extensively, both with the minister and with Mr. Medici on this, at minister's office, and the matter is on review and be dealt with by the courts in the very near future. Hopefully, the papers are about complete, will be complete shortly, and then hopefully we get an urgent trial date from the Gauteng High Court to get an urgent date, so the matter can be settled once and for all. The issue that relates to that also is the, I just want to put it up for future discussion, is the issue that the minister raised with regard to lifers and when lifers are considered. Now that issue is a very serious issue. It places this country in a situation worse than it was in the apartheid era, because now the decision with regard to the release of lifers is a sole decision of the minister. Whereas since 1982 and years thereafter, the minister acted on the advice of a national council. The national council is constituted not simply of lawyers, who may have their own peculiar view of the world, prejudiced and coloured by their own possible insensitivity to what happens in the ground. The national council consists of people from all walks of life, from judges to lay people, psychologists, psychiatrists, and the release of lifers was done on the basis of a recommendation of a carefully considered decision on each lifer. Each lifer was considered by the entire council, and the entire council made a recommendation which made the task of the political head much simpler. That, by the court, the wisdom of the Constitutional Court has now done away with that. I just mentioned that the Constitutional Court was not unanimous, that the two judges dissented, and if I may respectfully venture the view that the two judges who dissented may have been in real terms the better option for the development of this country. But unfortunately it's the highest water of the land, and we're bound by that. You must have heard the minister debate that on TV the other day. She did a very capable job of indicating to South Africa as a whole as to what the consequences are. It's the Van Vieren judgment. Its consequences have taken the rug from under our feet with regard to lifers, but has placed in jeopardy the careful calculation of recommendation with regard to lifers. And Mr. Chairman, if I may indicate, take the liberty of indicating to you that that aspect should be subject of debate before you for an entire morning because of its consequences. The issue of the issue that you raise of the correctional centre that you mentioned, I forget the name now. Dirkop. Perhaps it's unwise, the Minister, Mr. Chairman, to discuss specific matters because it's a public forum to mention people's names. Perhaps we could do, I don't know, I'm in your hands on that. But that particular case, I'm fully aware of that. I considered that matter. the issue of recidivism, the issue of restorative justice is policy in the department. It's not an overriding consideration to the release, not to the release of an offender. It's one of the factors which are taken into account. Let me just illustrate to you how we dealt with it in the past, we dealt with it effectively. We had once a lady who had killed her husband with a crossbow. It was a gruesome murder. And her daughter kept on writing to us, saying, look, this woman hasn't told the truth. It must have been accompanied by somebody else. And they agitated the family that she'd not be released. We referred the matter back, which was also not a lifer. And we sent it back for consideration. And for about 6 to 12 months, it carried on. And there was mediation by various parties. And when the situation arose, where they still could not reconcile, the complainant didn't want to accept the fact that the offender had not spoken the truth in her view, we eventually released the offender. But before releasing that offender, we had a long process, we instituted the process, attempted not simply reconciliation, which may be a biblical term, probably a political balance in this country, but the restorative justice, the effect to restorative justice, where the process of mediation between the two. Now, in the case that you mentioned, it's not simply the fact that lives in KZN. Firstly, you're sentenced to 30 years of imprisonment. We're not there to second guess why you were sentenced to 30 years. We accept the outcome of what the court has said. A person sentenced to 30 years imprisonment has committed, has offended, and has offended seriously. And we have to take that into account. The first factor for release on parole is firstly the seriousness of the offence, but not insofar in the same way that judges consider serious for purposes of sentencing. But we take into account the seriousness of the offence to determine the likelihood of the offender reoffending. Because our ultimate task would be to protect society from those who have committed very serious offences. So we had an offender who had committed sentence of 30 years imprisonment. Secondly, he'd barely served a third of his sentence. Thirdly, there was a petition, and I know in courts of law petitions are not really factors which are taken into account, but the entire community, a substantial portion of the community, objected to his release. It was in that context of the substantial reaction towards his release from the community concerned that Mr. Modise brought this matter to our attention as head of the Gauteng DCS. And we considered it, and what we then did was not to reject or reverse the decision to release him in its entirety just for purposes of the immediate release of the offender, but we suggested that a period of 6 months, that it's not simply that there be a reconciliation, there's already been an attempt at reconciliation, but the proposal was, and we had liberty to impose such conditions, was that a mediator be appointed between the community and this person, so that he, at the end of the day, can be released into a community which accepts him. You know, it's not simply, correctional service is very unlike the ordinary justice system. It's not simply a person accepting. We had an instance, and I say so, the instance where we failed. In my time in correctional services, we released a guy who was a perfect candidate to be released. He was involved in a taxi or tribal faction fight in a Transkei. And he was a perfect candidate to be, and we released him. Within a month, 20 years later, he was then killed by the faction. People don't forget when their loved ones die. So in this case, where there's been a serious murder, where there's community resentment against the early release, potentially early release of an offender, I think it's not only necessary but incumbent upon us to seriously weigh up all the relevant factors which we consider before releasing an offender. In this case, we did not say that he cannot be released. We said the matter should be postponed for 6 months. There should be mediation between the community and the offender, or the people that are objecting, or those who represent that community, the victims of his crime, and that the DCS, in fact, appoint a mediator. So we went a great length to ensure not simply the release of that offender, but his re-entry into society in the most acceptable way. The release of offenders, especially those who have offended seriously, is a very difficult task. I do not envy the minister having to decide now the content of the constitution to decide alone how to release an offender. Because at the back of your mind, each time you see a lifer, you see a person who has offended seriously, and there must be a fair measure of certainty that he will not re-offend again. And if a person has committed murder, raped a child, or we have mass murders, what are the likelihood of them re-offending? What the court, in my humble view, misunderstood in the Van Vieren judgment with regard to lifers was that we don't have a death penalty anymore. When the death penalty went, we floundered around to how to best to adjust the correctional services system. Because a simple, cruel fact perhaps is that there are certain people that can never be reintroduced to society. We don't have a death penalty anymore. It may be cruel to say so, but there are many offenders for the simple reason that they are dangerous until that they are on a deathbed. We will not be able to release them. The notion that 20 years and 25 years and figures are bandied about, but those figures are only guidelines which we as humble human beings introduced to make the process simpler. And without having the death penalty, which I don't propose, I oppose it all my life, but now that we must have the death penalty anymore, there are those people who spend a great deal of their lifetime, not their entire lifetimes, incarcerated. And there is no other alternative. I mean, we have the case that keeps on coming up of a pedophile murderer, a very serious case in KZN, where the judge did not hang the offender then because he was one of the most liberal judges of the era, but he did say the only reason not hanging him because he was young. But what does one do in such a case? There can never be a guarantee that a person won't offend again. But what we can do is this: exercise a collective view from all walks of life, and then take a decision, a collective decision, on what the risks are to society and how the best way we can show the charity of mankind by releasing an offender who has offended seriously.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, just to add to what my colleague has said regarding contacting the victim or the family of the victim.
Hello.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. The other aspect that I want to bring forward is that it is very important that the victims or the family of the victims should be contacted. There is a decided case which says that that is a very important aspect. You'd remember with the case of the late Chris Hardy, the wife was not contacted when the parole board considered the case, and the judge said it was important. However, some of the things that create problems, especially in cases which do not involve lifers, is that these matters would go to the parole board. And the parole board, they also need to be educated that when they deal with an application for parole, they should try to get all the files of the co-accused and deal with them together. Because there may be a case where two people
who committed the same offense, one parole board would release a person. When the others recommend a release, that matter would come to the review board. And the review board would consider other aspects and think that no, it is important that the family or the victims should be contacted. However, on this aspect, we realize that the other problem regarding contacting the victim is that when the court passes sentence, they don't inform the victims to give their particulars to the correctional services, so that if paroles are considered, the correctional services department can contact them. But now the least that they can do when the parole is considered is that at least there should be some steps or something indicating in the file that those victims have been contacted. However, if they cannot be contacted, then that is not a bar to releasing somebody on parole. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you to the NCCS and to the Minister. I do think Judge Desai that
Chairperson, thank you very much. I think that I should add that one of the biggest challenges that we have currently with this system is a lack of standard operational procedures. Where you visit a center and you come across inmates who will insist that they've been trying to get the officials to transfer them to a particular center. And when you investigate, the reason, rationale behind that is that the parole board in that center is more sympathetic, I guess, to the inmates. And of course, this is not the incident, the Waterkloof incident, where two of the accused have been released on parole, is not the only one. Even with lifers, we've come across this, that you have lifers who have applied. We have appeared for the parole board as a result of the Van Vieren ruling. And we discover that, in fact, their co-accused were released a year or two before in a different center. So as you deny, if you have to deny parole for this lifer, the lifer goes to court and claims and cites the fact that there is another co-accused, an accomplice who was released earlier. So these are some of the biggest challenges we have. But the matter which I wanted to draw your attention to, talking about minimum sentencing, is that, Chair, we have a number of cases which are coming up now of people who were given, let's say, 30-year sentence, right, or a 40-year sentence. The Van Vieren ruling has allowed for a process of lifers, some of them being considered eligible for parole when they serve 20, 21 years of their time. But you have a person who's sentenced to 40 years or 35 years, and the judge, in his ruling, makes some comments that this person will not be eligible for parole. He will only be eligible for parole when he has served 25 years or 30 years. That's one of the biggest problems that I've been having right now. Because these are people who were not given a life term. Yes, they may have committed gruesome crimes, but they were not given a life sentence. But we find that lifers now are eligible for consideration, and yet these people were given a 30-year term, 35-year term, will not be eligible for parole until such time they have served 30 to 35 years. And in this case, what happens then is that they petition me directly that minister should apply her mind on this one. It's a very, very difficult and a very tricky matter to deal with. But these are sentencing remarks which are made by the judges. So it's a matter that at some point the portfolio committee should be seized with. Maybe for purpose of engaging the Department of Justice, I don't know. We also have a case right now in KZN where we sentencing remarks said this person should apparently this man committed a rape, a young girl, clearly a pedophile. I don't know whether a repeat offender or not. But the judge said, "This you will only release this man when there is proof and evidence that this person is not sexually active." Now, the man has repeatedly requested to the official directly to my office to allow the Department of Health and the Department of Correctional Services to castrate him. And of course, we can't do that. We don't have the right to do that. It's wrong. But the man has already served 15 years of his time. And I don't know how we will prove that the man is now not sexually active. So we have those kinds of cases where, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know, I don't want to be seen to be perhaps critical to the work of the judiciary, but where a judge makes that kind of comment and therefore makes it, thereby making it difficult for all of us to take a decision to either grant, or even if we believe the person is now eligible. And this person is now isolated in a cell, has served the 15 years term in a single cell, locked away from everybody else. And he can never be eligible until there's proof, there's evidence that he's not sexually active. I don't know how you determine that. But these are some of the cases which I believe should be brought before the portfolio committee at some point for a discussion for purposes of engaging with the Department of Justice, so that we perhaps the Department of Justice can discuss with the judiciary some of the cases that we have in our correctional center. Because this person is not supposed to serve life, but there is no way he can be eligible for parole, so for consideration. So it's a big, big problem right now. There's another case we're dealing with from Barberton. Person was given 30 years. Judge rules that this person must serve 25 years. Lifers are eligible for consideration, and this person can be considered. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Minister. All right. But I think Minister has indicated she wants to leave at 5:30. We just want 5 minutes before she leaves. So we can continue this discussion, but for 5 minutes we just want to address the Minister or appraise the Minister of something. So if by 5:25 we've not done with this, we'll suspend it so that we can address the Minister. Honourable Makakula, self, and then Mangwenya.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry to be late. My question first to the judge. About this life. This thing, it goes beyond. When we visit the centers, we find the inmates with a newspaper, with the picture of the minister and their names. And they said, "I was not supposed to be here by now." This is what the minister has been said. And is there with them. They are having those papers. So it is very difficult. You take a long route. You discuss a lot of things until it gets to the names of the lifers. And it goes beyond. You publish the names openly. So really, if the lifers are still there, is a problem, and is a question. Sometimes they will target the department. They'll fight with the department because this thing is in black and white. They are with the newspapers in the cells. They said, "We're not supposed to be here by now." the picture of the minister is there. I know even the date of the city press. So really, the department or whatever didn't check it correct if the lifers are still there. And then when we are there, when we visit there, they need an answer, and then we don't have an answer. It did happen in Barbados, Minister. Another thing, Minister, is the issue of voice, the inmate. That has been sentenced 30 years, and then the judge said he must stay at least 25 years inside. To us. Also, I think, Minister, there is something that must happen here in this country. We have to also to remember that we are coming from the apartheid era, and the judges were like that towards us as a black people. Some of the judgment, you feel that, no, this is having some hands of this the then government. And when you follow up, well, what is this man did, you'll find that he's not even in threat in his community. And what he did, you'll find that he was protecting himself. But because of the court of law, he go all these processes. But the judgment, you feel that, no, it is not good. That inmate that we're spoken about, he even appeared to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and the commission said the judgment was too harsh. It's in black and white from the commission. But really, I know that minister can't do anything because of this judgment. But really, it's unfair. Some of the judgment were very harsh, especially to us as a blacks. So I don't know what we're going to do, and because the man is there, is behaving, even the communities, they want him. But really, I don't know what will happen, Minister. I know it's a question, but it's something that you raise it, really is unfair sometimes, I think.
Thank you, Chair. I would agree with Judge Desai that I think that Sanfiran judgment, with the greatest respect, was the wrong approach to this thing, and I think it places an almost impossible burden on the Minister to perform a function that isn't part of her core functions, I would have thought. But I guess we are bound by that. But the bigger problem, I think, is the one that the Minister outlined, which is when you can get a difference between somebody who has been sentenced to life imprisonment, which is presumably the most severe sentence that you can hand down, the most serious sentence that you can hand down, and yet you get a situation where somebody is nominally given a less serious sentence but serves a longer period of imprisonment. Now, clearly that's wrong. Now, the Minister has invited us to have an interaction with the Portfolio Committee on Justice, and I think it's a very good idea, and we've been talking about it for some time. But I would hope that there's a two-pronged approach to this, and that on the executive level as well, there's a conversation that takes place, because, you know, it's also in the execution of these decisions and these policies that many of the problems lie. And one of those things is the Section 73 incarceration framework, which we've grappled with as a portfolio committee over many, many years. And if you recollect, in about 2008, we tried to put it into the Act, and then it was taken out of the Act because it's actually an executive function and not a legislative function. And yet, so many of these decisions are affected by the incarceration framework. So many of these decisions are affected by the proper, in my view, definition of a release date. And I guess the question that I would want to put would some of these problems be resolved by legislating? And if so, is legislation necessary to place many of these things beyond beyond doubt?
Thank you, Chairperson.
Sorry,
it's difficult.
Yes, sir.
It's difficult to answer.
There's
lots more questions.
We're going to take two more. Okay. Please, if you can just note them. Otherwise, we'll be here forever. Because there will be follow-up to your follow-up. We'll allow just for two more, and we'll allow everybody to respond to it. Mam Ganya?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I would like to thank the Minister for coming to our court follow committee to brief us. Thanks very much, Minister. And secondly, Chair, I would like to support the view of a meeting with the Department of Justice jointly, as our cluster, to solve this problem, because this is not the problem that maybe we started to discuss it today. But the solution of this problem is for us to meet jointly with the Department of Justice. In terms of the question, I don't have any questions, Chairperson. I was just supporting that. Thank you.
Thanks, Ma'am Gwenya. We'll allow for responses from the Minister and the NCCS. But just to say that we certainly will call a joint meeting between Justice, Portfolio Committee, Correctional Services, and we'll invite the NCCS. In fact, last week already, Modise will recall that we said we need to have a discussion around parole. Because one, it's not uniform. It raises expectations in certain instances that are so difficult, Minister, to manage. Because we deal with it, and you, I would assume as well, have to respond to these people every day. So we had suggested it last week, but I think that is the suggestion that we call NCCS and DOJ. We will do. We'll ask Cindy to fast track that as well. We will try and change our program. So on that one, we are comfortable. And then we can deal with the issues raised by Mr. Self and about voice in KZN. Not in KZN, in Barberton. Let me just say on the voice matter, Minister, I think we had alerted you when we got back, but we also spoke to the Department of Justice and the chair of that portfolio committee, together with the, I think it's the Petitions Committee, have decided to take it upon themselves as well. We've raised it with them. Certainly, Honorable Landers and the chair of the Petitions Committee are also looking at it on the voice matter. But I guess Makakula feels strong enough, because it's his hometown boy, that he raises it every time it comes up. Over to you, Minister, and to NCCS.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I'm sorry that Honorable Makakula is not here, because I think it's important to... I've just been thinking, what paper is this? Now, I recall that following the Van Vieren Constitutional Court ruling, we had an advert in all the newspapers where we actually listed the names of people who will be eligible for consideration as a result of this ruling. We, in fact, were calling on victims to come forward, because obviously I was saying, look, it's going to be very difficult. We have plus minus 200 people who have to be considered within a short space of time. And obviously the restorative process has not been done to prepare for this. So what we needed to do is to call on victims to come forward. Now, the only way you can get the victim to come forward, obviously you would have had to list the name. And that advert does not say that you are eligible for release. It actually says these are the people who will be considered eligible for consideration as a result of the Van Vieren ruling. I don't remember the formulation, but I want to assume that that's what it said. And of course, it listed plus minus 400 of those lifers who were to be considered at the time. And that's what they are holding on to. But you know what, honorable members? since coming to correctional services, you know, initially when I came in, I didn't think I would survive this portfolio because it's an emotionally draining portfolio, particularly when you visit correctional. If you are a minister who sits in the office and not go to the centers, I'm sure it would not have the kind of impact that it has had. But you have this interaction with individual inmates when you visit the center. And some of the things that you come across are such that it would be easy for me to take particular positions that can actually offend the South African community. I've actually learned now to stop being emotional and remove myself from the case and from the individual and just look at the paper. I'm saying this because as you move around, indeed there are inmates who are ready to be out, to be released on parole, who should not be in our correctional facilities. And some of them should never have gone to our facilities in the first instance. But equally, there are those who certainly, if you look at the cases and you read the profile over and over again, and even the psychologist's report will tell you that here there's a problem, it's going to be very difficult to rehabilitate this person. But when you interact with the person at a personal level,
he's
such an angel. So I'm just saying that we have to learn. It's very difficult though, but I've had to learn with speed to say, look, here is an individual. At a personal level, I wish I could, but by all accounts, when I read at some of the things that the person has done and continues to do at the correctional facilities, it's not possible for us to consider. I'm saying this because they will not tell you when you talk to them that, in fact, my last offense was in 2011, where I strangled another inmate. You will only get that information when you read the profile of the person. That's, I'm not saying this particular case. I'm familiar with this case, Barberton case. In fact, I've referred that case to the review committee. That particular case that you are referring to, the Barberton one. But what is strange, though, there are many instances where the TRC Amnesty Committee made remarks. Maybe Dr. Randera at some point will shed light on this one, would make a comment that the sentence given to this individual is very harsh, this and that, a whole long thing, but never considered granting. In some instances, the Amnesty Committee would go as far as to say, in fact, this person, we believe that this person is should never have been sent to the correct. In other words, this person should never have been found guilty. However, the person could not prove the motive, whether in fact indeed it was politically motivated or not. And then they send the person back to a correctional facility. And now those things are stuck with us. So there is that as well. But this particular case, as I say, I've referred it to the review team to say, look, can you just look at this case, because I don't have the power to take a decision to release this person concerned. I don't. Last matter, Chair, which I think I should mention to you, and perhaps the team or corporate services should come and brief you on this one. Our Achilles heel in the department is the case management committee. In my view, it doesn't matter who you appoint in the parole board, it doesn't matter how capable the people are, but for as long as we do not have a properly structured case management committee, we're going to continue to have the kinds of problems that we have. Because when you look at some of the cases, you think this case should never have even gone before the parole board, or this case should never have been on my desk. But it is there because the case management committee has drafted something, and when you read the report that comes from the case management committee, in fact, there's every reason from the beginning to say, but this should not have come to the parole board or even to the MCPS. So what we have decided It's precisely because of the lack of capacity on the side of the case management committee. And we've now taken a Port Fire decision, which I believe Corporate Services is implementing, of actually getting legal practitioners in each one of the centers who will be part of the case management committee and will be responsible for the drafting of the profile of the inmate. Because if we don't do that and we leave it to ordinary correctional officers to do it, we'll continue to kind of have these challenges that we have. So the Corporate Services and Human Resource Unit was now looking at JEing those posts, whether it is going to be possible to do it or not. And of course, that would be a team of legal practitioners who will link directly with Tando in the office of the NCCS and just make sure that there is synergy, even in the manner in which the reports are compiled for consideration by the parole court. For now, what you have is an ordinary correctional officer with a security officer who will chair a CMC, and after the CMC, after drafting the report, will go back and do his work of looking after inmates. That's not what we need right now. We need full-time capacity to deal with all cases of people who should appear before parole board. Not talking about life as per se now, I'm just talking general, that our case management committees are a big problem, and that's what we're trying to deal with, right? We're grappling with it, actually. And we've had to say, look, let's look at area of capacity by looking at who goes into the case management committee. We need people who are going to be full-time to do this work, and at least people who have some legal background. That's what we're trying to do. I would hope that that will assist us to be able to deal with some of the challenges that I've alluded to earlier on. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you. Before I comment on the questions, I omitted to introduce to the committee a minister referred to her as Ms. Tando Setsewa. We are indebted to the minister for giving us the services of Ms. Setsewa. She's full-time employed to assist the National Council, and that will advance the quality of work we do tremendously. She's a trained lawyer, so it'll be a great assistance to us and to the department generally. Thank you very much for that. Mr. Magavula, sorry if I say your name incorrectly. I can assure you I've been since 1996, some stage or the other, with the National Council, certainly since I've been chair. We've been alert to the nuances that South Africa of necessity creates, and we've been alert to the fact that certain judges, in certain instances, would have sentence people more severely because of the color of their skin. And we've done the best we can to ameliorate the situation. It has not always been easy, been bound by rules, but where we had a sense that something was really wrong, we've done what we could to solve the situation, to soften the blow for the life of the offender before us. So you can take my assurance that as long as in the times when the matter came before me, we did what we could to assist the offender. The other issue raised is a more difficult one. The minister simply put an advert in the paper, in the Voice, and saying that people are eligible for consideration on parole. Now, that's an aspect that's often lost in translation, if I may say so. Even DCS loses the sight of the ball sometimes. Consideration means exactly you're entitled to be considered at that stage. It does not mean that you are to be released on that date. And very often you see press reports saying that a person who is sentenced to life imprisonment is being sentenced to 25 years in jail. That is not correct. In South Africa, life imprisonment means imprisonment to the rest of your natural life. But you may be considered for parole at different stages. So I think we must do more to alert not simply the department, but public as a whole, that the mere fact that you're sentenced life imprisonment means exactly that unless certain factors come into play. The other problem also with the issue that you raised is that when you go to correctional centers, and this happened in the Jali Commission, you accept what the offender tells you. Offenders give you their own version of what has happened. They don't want to be inside. None of us want to be inside. They want to get out. And they see it in the most manner most liberal to themselves as to get themselves out. So very often we must be very careful, unless there's objective verification, if what an offender is, in fact, I'm not saying they shouldn't rely on them, but in serious matters of concern, we should look for some objective verification of what they say. Visitors, I mean, over the years I've seen hundreds of misrepresentations by offenders, especially as to regard to the offence they've committed. They'll tell a clinical psychologist, look, I'm in jail for this, and the recorder there is in jail for doing X, Y, and Z. Why is he in jail if he committed that? He should have been acquitted. But then look for the SFP 62, which is the report the police make after a person is in the police, they did X, Y, totally different, much more serious an offence. So just simply to emphasize that the release of offenders is a serious consideration, and whilst taking into account the multiplicity of factors, including the factual circumstances under which he was, as I said earlier on, what he was convicted of is important to determine the issue as to whether he is likely to reoffend. But just to two other aspects. The 25 years where the judges recommend, there's a slight difference to that. Sometimes judges made a recommendation. The correctional service is not bound by that recommendation. Where the sentence of 25 years is imposed in terms of some legislation, they'll be bound by it. But more often than not, there's expressive views that judges express, which 20 years down the line may not be significant or important. So I'm not disagreeing with what the minister says, but there are certain instances we can in fact disregard what the judge said. But more often than not, there'll be some relevance to it insofar as the offence itself is concerned. Now, the most important issue is obviously van Vieren judgment. Now, we've toyed with that idea, and we are toying with the idea of amending the legislation. But the problem is this: the van Vieren judgment is a far-reaching judgment. It makes as a definitive finding that each offender sentenced at a particular stage is bound by the regime that prevailed at that stage. Prison regime, parole regime that bound at that stage. It loses sight that parole is a developing social phenomenon that political people from time to time and statutory organs can determine the circumstances under which a person can be released. If you're bound by the majority judgment on van Vieren, then we'll be sitting with the problems that judgment creates for the next 20 years. So that case does create serious problems for those who exercise parole professionally. It misses the ball in its entirety. The minority judgment obviously gets the issue right. I don't think we can simply deal with the matter by amending the legislation here and there. What we may have to do, and that's the minister's option and prerogative, would be to redo parole legislation in its entirety and then get it through the constitutional court. But that's the issue the minister will have to grapple with on our side. Thank you.
Thank you so much to the minister and to the NCCS. Minister, just about 5 minutes time. I think this discussion, because I really thought it was going to be your input, one or two questions, and move. That's what I envisaged. But this emphasizes, I think, what as the committee we want to relay to you, Minister. We have a practice, Minister, where we issue out the year planner or the term planner well in advance so that yourself and the department are able to do the necessary planning. We also, in preparation for the hearing, Minister, would send correspondence to the department saying, look, we are meeting next week or in 2 weeks' time. We need you to bring to the committee this type of information so that we could study it and have a meaningful discussion. And we need that 7 days before the time. That has been the standard. Commissioner Moyani has, on numerous occasions, made that undertaking, even saying that when it comes, the quality control would have been done, so that we can have a meaningful discussion. Today, Minister, we were going to discuss specifics around the parole matter that we picked up. We have been engaging with the department, the last with Mr. Marisa, at least the 13th of February, around issues like the Crosby matter and so on. And in all those meetings, we would say, this is what we picked up, please respond to us, and so on. But we've reached a point, Minister, where, as we speak today, we're unable to have that discussion around parole because information was submitted to the committee last night around parole matters. And we thought we'd have a meaningful discussion with you. Last night it was submitted. None of the members have sight of it as we speak. And we have submitted this matter to the department from February last year. And this is just an example of many incidents. So the committee really feels that we were going to bring it to your attention if you want. In fact, we were going to write to the speaker and to yourself, but now that you're here, it will be my convention, just to intervene on our behalf. That if we're going to have a meaningful discussion, that we do need documentation, at least 7 days so that member can consider. Because we think that the integrity of Parliament has to be protected. And it cannot be protected if we are not able to have a meaningful discussion because documentation is outstanding. So we thought we would bring this to your attention. We were going to raise it, and after having afforded the department an opportunity to explain why this information is not forthcoming for this meeting, maybe then write to you. And I think it's still appropriate to do that, Minister, because we don't want to take the committee secretary's view only. We'd rather have a discussion, but really it makes life difficult for these members here. They'd raised it with me last night, and I undertook to discuss it with the department and then write to yourself or to the speaker, because we cannot continue it with whatever we're going to do today. So our appeal is just for you to intervene on this matter. I'm not sure if the department was going to have its own response, but really, as we speak, we do not have a single piece of information because Cindy received it at 3 o'clock last night. And it was matters that we thought we would share with you because they were really on specifics so that we could deal with the specifics. I'm not sure if members want to say anything. We'll then allow Minister and the Department to say whatever it is that they want to say, but I thought I'd try to capture the sentiment of the Department. I'm not sure if anything else. Otherwise, it was really for information and an appeal for intervention from your side, Minister. Just give me 1 second, Cindy seems to be... Yes, I did say 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon. No, Cindy is just confirming that the information arrived at her at 3 o'clock. She needs to collate it and then submit it to members. And then, as we speak, we don't even have it right now. So it's really about intervention, and it's about just alerting you that it really makes our work difficult. I don't see members wanting to say anything. I think it's captured it. Thank you very much, Minister, for your information and for your intervention, ma'am.
Chair, let me start by thanking the Portfolio Committee for inviting me to appear before the Portfolio Committee to introduce the NCCF. I must say that on a number of occasions this year, I have wanted to appear before the Portfolio Committee and to brief the Portfolio Committee on a number of events that have occurred in the department. But obviously, unfortunately, at times I'll be informed that there's a specific item on the agenda which it requires the department to appear and not the minister. Let me start by saying that. So I really appreciate the opportunity. I wish I could be invited again. I don't want to impose myself on the committee because there are a number of matters, issues that we need to discuss with the committee. But secondly, the matter that you are raising now is very familiar. It sounds very familiar to me. I believe what you are telling me, because it is an experience that I have in the department on a daily basis. And I think it's a matter that I've discussed with you before, that, you know, we're dealing with a very, very difficult department where people are not used to accountability. In fact, I've actually said to the commissioner, "Commissioner, please, just get people to account. Get people to account to you as an accounting officer." Because, you know, Chair, we work with information. On my side as minister as well, I can only be able to take decisions to do things when I'm given the information. But most of the time, you have to really put pressure on people to give you. Even when you prepare for a simple meeting, the Executive Management Committee meeting, it's difficult for people to supply you with information way before the meeting with reports. But in fact, they are coming to present reports to you. So I don't know whether the purpose is not to allow me to interrogate the reports. That's my view. That's what I've been saying. In fact, if I may say, just talking about this, only 2 weeks ago we had a management meeting, and there was a big fight there because I requested the department and I gave them a deadline to submit information to my office in preparation for the budget vote on very specific matters. And up until we went to that meeting, deadline had passed, information is not coming forth. And it has been a And I said to the National Commissioner, "You are the National Commissioner, I'm the Minister. I do not want to be seen to be micromanaging the department. But at times, it has become necessary for one to really, you know, micromanage in order for me to get the information that I need." Okay? Now, we're having a budget vote on the 16th of May. And in the 2 years that I've presented a budget to Parliament, I've actually had to get managers to come and camp in Cape Town for 3 days before the budget vote in order for me to get information that I require, not information that they want to give to me, but information which I want, which should go into my speech. I'm saying to you, and at the risk of being seen to be whinging and complaining about officers who are under my authority, but I'm saying there is serious resistance to giving information. I think it's a culture which is rooted in the department that you keep information away, so you are unable to then move and take decisions because there's no information. Now, I see also and I'm sorry to say this, 18 years into our democracy, sometimes I think when I look at what is happening in the department, people have not woken up to the fact that we're not dealing with the kind of department of prison that we used to have. We have a correctional services department, and therefore the approach to many, many things that we do should be different. And I think accountability is one of those. I think people just find it very difficult to come forward and say, okay, this is the information that we have. They believe that information is power, and if I keep this information, and in the Department of Correctional Services, there shouldn't be a principle to work on a need-to-know basis, really, on most of the matters. But I think people are still stuck in that. You can raise this with a CDC, and he'll tell you that this is my fight every day with them. But, Chair, I will intervene by having a discussion with the National Commissioner. And for the record, I do want to say that the discussion that I will have with the National Commissioner on this matter is a discussion which I had last week with the Deputy Minister and the National Commissioner, where we're raising exactly the same issue. But look, you are not giving us information on very serious matters, actually. Because sometimes you wake up in the morning and you read in the paper about something that is very easy, that could have been reported to you, just on a pager and sent to your office so that you are aware.
Okay.
So I'm just trying to say, I'm just saying that I think that it's a culture thing. It's so rooted, and I think some of them, and I don't want to say all of them, Shay, I think some of them are slowly coming out of it, but it's very difficult because it has been there for some time, and people find it difficult to do away with a culture of not reporting and accounting. Lastly, Chair, I want to make a special appeal to the Portfolio Committee and perhaps to the NCCS, we can have that discussion some other time, to go on a roadshow and plead with victims of crime to come forward. That is the biggest problem in this country. And I can understand, I mean, from a woman point of view, I can imagine if I had been raped, I would want to walk away from it and not ever remember. And perhaps when you are called on to come forward and appear before a public court, some of the people find it very difficult to go back to the past. I'm assuming that this is the case, because in this difficult situation which I found myself in, of having to take a decision on some of these lifers, you'll see that if you see the statistics, there are very few people who've benefited from this process. I probably have 55 who were released, who've been released, a number of about 100 and something who are on day parole. The rest are sitting in the centers, and they don't understand why. And my view is that they should never, particularly people who have committed gruesome crimes against women and children in this country, that they should never be even considered eligible for just for consideration before a restorative justice process has been embarked upon, where the views of the victim can be heard. Even though that is not the sole determining factor, whether the person is going to be allowed to walk out or not, but just to hear the victim out and to prepare the victim for the ultimate decision whether to release or not release the perpetrator. We're trying in our own way to do it, but I think that as the Portfolio Committee moves around at the center, but also in our constituencies, through our constituency offices, in our communities, this is something that we need to preach, that victims of crime should not shy away from coming forward, because that's the only way in which we can strengthen our restorative justice process. For now, it is a big, big problem. If you look at the lifers that we've considered, it's a very small group. In fact, a very small group has come forward to say, look, this is how I feel about this. It's a problem in our society right now. And the only way in which we can win back the hearts of the victim is for us to embark on a public awareness program about the importance of these victims appearing before the parole board. But of course, the parole board, some of the parole boards are new, and we are in the process of appointing more. Vice chairs, I think, have come up already. Some of the people that we appoint are very good people, very hardworking, trying their best, but they've just not been able to make an impact in those communities to get the victims to come forward. And some of the victims will say, look, I've walked away from this. I do not want to know. I do not want to remember. I do not want to see the person. And you cannot force me to come into this process. So that's the approach. When you talk to them at times, people see you as forcing them to do it, but that's not the case. We want to achieve a different outcome. So I think that if us politicians could actually buy into this and be the ones who spread the gospel of victim empowerment, of restorative justice process, maybe there will be a different Some of them will say, for instance, what's the point? Well, you are going to take a decision anyway, whether to release or not. What's the point? Why should I come? But maybe when it is said by people who are not necessarily from the Department of Correctional Services, it will have a better effect. And the reception may be positive. And I want to thank you once more, Chair, for allowing us to, in particular, to appear before the Portfolio Committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. Minister, we will... It's been very difficult because of your schedule and even our own schedule, but it would be helpful, Minister. I do think the department has been hankering to talk to you on a whole host of matters. If your office are able to say to us, these are the days that you're available, I'm sure Cindy will change it. On many days, unfortunately, we meet on a Wednesday and it clashes with Cabinet, unfortunately. But I'm sure if you said this is the Tuesday or this is whatever, Cindy is able to ask for permission from Parliament because of the circumstances. But we certainly would want to have an engagement with you, and as soon as we receive the dates that you are available, we will amend our schedule accordingly. In fact, Cindy is indicating to me that next week, in fact, we had planned, on the 2nd, I beg your pardon, yeah, for next week, we had planned an interaction with yourself and the Deputy Minister together with the Department and Labour. Mr. Modise would recall that in old Assembly we had said we would have this meeting where we can look at the progress of the 7-day establishment and the OSD. But it clashes unfortunately with the Wednesday, so if Minister is able to say to us, these are the specific days, Tuesday or Wednesday, I'm sure we'd be able to adjust our program accordingly. We do need at least 2 weeks notice so that we can notify you and get whatever we need to you that you would require or from you that we would require. But definitely we will undertake to meet with you at least once a quarter, if at the very worst, be once a quarter. But if we can meet you every month, I'm sure the committee would be grateful to do that. So thank you very much, Minister. It is
yes,
a few.
Can I just say that yes, Wednesday is never a good day. It's Cabinet Day. If it is not Cabinet, Cabinet is held every second week, fortnight. But only like today is not Cabinet Day. But at 10:30, there's a joint meeting of Cabinet. Okay? Because as issues come up, sometimes instead of calling a Cabinet meeting, was not a Cabinet week, then there's a joint meeting of all Cabinet committees. So Tuesday is always a better day for me to appear before the Portfolio Committee. But I also want to remind you, Chair, that I requested you last week that I would like to have a consultation just for 10 minutes with the Portfolio Committee in camera. I said just 10 minutes because there are some developments which you need to be aware of. Thank you.
Members were in fact informed and we had all agreed. I think you had a deployment to Africa somewhere. But yes, Minister, as soon as you have, we will try and organize it for Tuesday or Thursday so that it ties into your, when you're in Cape Town next week. Unless you want something today, we can do it today, Minister.
It's rather late, Chair.
Oh,
it will be rather late.
Oh.
Remember, I would have wanted this consultation last week with you.
All right.
And it is an important matter which I believe I should at least inform the Portfolio Committee about.
All right. We have two agenda items. The second one was on the parole board, which we've agreed can't take place. So we do have time. If Minister has got 10 to 15 minutes, we've got 10 to 15 minutes. Most of us are here, and we can do it. Is that right with members of the committee? Because we are done with our first agenda item. Once again, to the NCC.
Can I just thank you on behalf of the council for inviting us here? We're available at any time to meet with you again.
Thank you very much, the NCCS. You will certainly get invited sooner rather than later on the parole matter. So thank you very much. And can we honour the minister's request just to be excused for about 10-15 minutes?